It's Wednesday, May 4th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 230 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes.
Hello and welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is
Pat. Shut the hell up.
I just got a taste for it last week, so yeah, my bad.
That was way better than you did last week.
No kidding.
Why couldn't you have done that last week when we needed it?
That was like your full Sunday announcer voice.
Give the man 1 week and he's drunk on power, but actually it's kind of the idea was to get Pat to drop some balls. So welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
This is Wayne.
This is Johan.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
Hi, Johan.
What's up, Chad?
Not much.
It's amazing how we're still not the same person, apparently.
No.
I won't believe it till I see one of you drinking a glass of water while the other's talking.
Chris, you had something. It's not exactly an announcement. It's just kind of a brief aside you wanted to hit on before.
Yeah, just a quick aside. I was, after I got done with work and was running around, I had to make a quick run to the grocery store. So knowing it's recording night and trying to get, you know, everybody psyched up for it, I decided to text all my fellow hosts. Apologies to Johan. Didn't know you were going to be visiting us monthly.
Only the important ones, I guess.
And just texting him saying, I'm running to the grocery store. What do you guys need me to pick up for you? And the responses I got back were pretty interesting. Dan, being very generous and thinking of everybody, says, get stuff for barbecue, for big old family barbecue. Pat texted for a bottle of yak, and I'm not exactly sure what you meant by that.
That's all right, Chris. You wouldn't understand from up north.
Wayne texted condoms because he knows where Pat has been.
That's wise.
And the best one probably was Chad, who didn't text me anything because, of course, Chad doesn't believe in making lists or rules about getting things.
Hey, it's whatever you need to get the most out of your text. That's what you should do.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you're just going to roll with whatever I get.
Yeah.
We may have our ideas, but there's no such thing as a wrong bad trip to the grocery store.
That's right.
As long as you walked away happy and satisfied, you had a good trip to the grocery store.
Do you role play with the staff? Do you talk to them? Do you look them in the eye? Do they have names to you? Or is this just something where you go in, you're looking for your loot, you go from aisle to aisle to aisle, clearing out each aisle, taking what you need, and then running out the store with it?
Wow, I totally dungeon run in stores.
Clear and shop.
There were some very interesting NPCs in the grocery store, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I don't even listen to the NPCs in the stores. I have headphones on. I throw my iPod out when I'm going through a store.
NPCs in the store.
It's amazing. I do the same thing while role-playing, so yeah.
You know,
NPCs? What the...
You know what? As a person who used to be an NPC in one of those stores, I have to say thank you. I really wish 99% of my customers who came through my line back in the day would treat me
actually,
with so little respect.
And you know what the grand irony is there? What's the question a GM hates to hear the most?
What?
What's his name?
Yeah.
And you actually at one point removed your name
tag. Yes,
badge.
I did. I not only removed my name tag, I put on a fake name tag with someone else's name.
Because the very question of what's your name became problematic.
Yeah, it was during that election where they had the hanging Chad issue, right?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And so there's like 10,000 jokes going on. Well, you know, the first couple of days, it's like, haha, yeah, that's fun. Oh, and you know what? I actually hadn't heard that one. And that sort of thing. And then day three, day four, week two, week three, month four, same jokes. I get 300 customers a day.
And they're all comedians.
And they're all, every single one of them tells the exact same joke. And I just, my mom bitched at me. She's like, you just don't have a sense of humor. I'm like, you don't even understand. You cursed me with this name.
You know, I have no sympathy for you because no one ever made a movie called Chad's World. They made Wayne's World. I hate that movie. I hate that phrasing so much. And the only thing that was as bad as that was I used to work at a store at Six Flags called Justice League. My name tag said Wayne. I'm working in Justice League headquarters with Wayne as my name tag. Do you know how many Bruce Wayne jokes came through every day?
As a man who has a Batman poncho, wasn't it like a dream come true?
Yeah, really, this should be a good thing for you.
That store was the reason I was working at the park. I went in as a guest and I saw the store and it's like, I have to work there. My first job was there to work in that store.
I have no sympathy for either one of you because I was called Piss Pussy back in high school by a few people. So
I used to know somebody whose... Her name is Anita. She married into the last name Woodcock.
I know someone named Harry Pickle. Nice. He goes by Sonny.
Nice.
I used to work down the road from Dickhead, so...
I was going to tell my Charlie's Angels story, but it pales in comparison to Anita Woodcock and Harry Pickle and Dickhead.
I've got another customer now whose name is Richard Craven.
Carla may have you guys all topped. There is a woman she works with.
Took me a minute to get, and I don't even know why.
I'm not making this up. She's an Asian woman, and her first name is Sook. Mm-hmm. Apparently her middle initial is A, and she married an American guy whose last name is Willie. I swear to you, I am not making this up.
Hey, I went to high school with, I think it was a guy named Nip. His last name was Lee, so he was Nipley. Yeah.
I bet he was.
Okay, I don't know where the hell we're going with all of this. Pat, control your show.
Nowhere good.
So, Wayne, you had something that you wanted to kick around.
Yeah, so what really got me thinking about this was I'm finally playing through the first Mass Effect. I bought it around Christmas when it dropped down to $2.99, and every time I talk about it, I hear one of two things. Oh, the game doesn't get good until you get past a certain point.
The Citadel.
Then you hear my opinion.
And then I hear Chad's, that game was really horrible. You asked where he gets to, and he got right about to the Citadel and quit right after that. And it got me thinking, as I played through it, I was agreeing up until that point. Yeah, the game really does get better after that. How much time should a person be willing to invest in a game for it to get good?
Because you spend five, six hours till the game gets good in Mass Effect.
Yeah, it was 6 hours before it got good.
Well, and I'll give you an example of one even more recent than Mass Effect that I think is even worse in that regard, which I enjoyed very much, which is Dragon Age 2. Because Dragon Age 2, when the game starts off, it is very plotless. It's very meandering. You're just this wandering errand boy until about 10 hours in when suddenly...
10 hours?
Yes, I'm not joking. It literally takes about 10 hours of gameplay when suddenly all these plot points come together. And so it's like, oh... That's why I did this, and this guy said that, and this person's in my party, and suddenly the game gets really good. And I've told people that it reminds me of the writings of Alexandre Dumas. If you've ever read books like The Count of Monte Cristo, there will be chapters where you're going through 30, 40, 50 pages of like, why is he telling me this? And then suddenly a chapter or two later, it's like, oh, this is, and that's what Dragon Age 2 reminded me of, but that game takes a painfully long time to get to the point. When Carl and I first met, one of the first things we found we had in common was we both enjoyed the plots of the Final Fantasy games. They're the same way. They take several hours before all these things they're foreshadowing and setting up finally come to an intriguing head.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VII, I don't think you get out of the actual first city until near the end of the first disc, if not the end of the first disc.
It is the end of the first disc, yeah.
And that's a lot of time to devote before you get freedom in a game.
Yeah, and it's not till right before you leave the city that the plot really starts to come together and get good.
I have to wonder, would you consider that a failure of a game? If it's a wonderful game you love, but it takes that long to get into... I have to think that there's a serious failure in game design.
Well, I think it depends on the type of game that you're playing. The games that you've really mentioned here, in my mind, are much more like their literary equivalent. Like, you're talking about this game like it's a book, and I think that's a very good comparison. Because you're saying that when you're sitting down and reading, say, a classic or something that's highly regarded, usually you're not just, oh my God, this is so awesome from page one. It takes you a while to get the story developed, to get it lined up, lay the groundwork, and then you start to get into the story. And I think those are the games you're talking about.
Book, though.
Now, there are other games that are much more, that are not like that. Like, well, Chad, for example, Portal 2. Mm-hmm. This is a game that you love anyway, but it's like you're immediately, I'm assuming, I haven't played it, you're right into doing the game.
It's not only from second one, but it's also
an 8-hour game.
Yeah.
These games are on the order of 50 hours plus.
My comeback to that would be that if I pick up a book and I start reading it, and it takes 10 hours of reading before it gets interesting, I'm not going to devote 10 hours to reading this book.
Well, I think it's not necessarily 10 hours, but you're going to be talking more like chapters. I mean, is it going to take you 4 or 5 chapters of reading, assuming a relative chapter size? It takes 50 pages of reading before it really starts to get its hooks into you.
Maybe you
drop it. It depends on your personality.
I actually find that the metaphor breaks down a little bit, comparing a book to a video game. Because if we say that, it's like, okay, this book is taking a long time to develop. Do I want to keep pushing through and slogging through this boring stuff till it starts paying off? Well, that's all I can do is read the book. That's all I can do is just read the book. In a video game, if the story and plot isn't developing, maybe that there's some other things that I'm doing that are interesting me along the way. Combat, exploration, mini quest, looking at the pretty scenery. Yeah, the plot's slow, But man, look at this fireball I'm casting, and I just killed a dragon no reason.
And this is where I thought Mass Effect 2 did better than Mass Effect 1. In Mass Effect 1, they're trying to teach you the setting, and they do it through this boring, never-ending cycle on the Citadel.
Right.
In Mass Effect 2, they're trying to teach you a little bit more about the setting, but they do it while you're fighting your way through a base, hitting tech terminals and getting little video clips on monitors as you're walking through, killing things and trying to figure out what's going on. They had a much better way of delivering that story. And so here's the thing. If I have a game like that or book like that or whatever, I tend to invest in my entertainment. I have a pretty long stamina before I will just give up throwing the hat and walk away. I'm pretty forgiving, maybe too forgiving, of these games that take a long time to get good. And I understand why other people don't want to, because I think you can make the case that, look, if you're going to present this entertainment to me, I accept maybe you can't drop me straight into the action in every story. It's not going to be exciting on the first page. But if you can't get me within the first two chapters, if you can't get me within the first hour of gameplay, you've screwed up. And I will say that about Dragon Age 2. Well, I thought the payoff was worth it. They screwed up. That game should have gotten interesting a whole lot faster than it did. Mass Effect, they should have really done something to make that Citadel less of this plot quagmire.
I really wanted to like Mass Effect. I really did.
I tried hard to like Mass Effect.
Dan loves Mass Effect. He loves him some Mass Effect. Talks about it constantly. You know, and Dan and I, one of our things that we share in this relationship that we have is a love.
Sex.
Is going balls deep, but is love of video games and the storytelling within a video game. And Dan and I will sit there, and we do this with a movie too, where we just dissect every little bit of this game that we've played together and just keep on chewing it up and chewing it up, chewing it up. I wish I could have gotten into Mass Effect so that we could talk about it.
It's okay. I'm his Mass Effect butt buddy.
I'm very jealous. But yeah, I really wanted to like this game. But Johan, you put it perfectly. That first part was an obstacle. I love to read. I love to read. They had huge walls of text that you had to go through and the history and the background and all this stuff. And it's just like, oh my God, I don't care. And it's just like, here, do this for this person, because isn't this person really great and weird and interesting? You want to learn about him? No, I don't want to learn about him. I don't know who the hell they are. Why do I care about him?
I would have actually enjoyed it more if instead of doing the Citadel section, they had just shipped the game with a novella.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
This is the backstory. And they used to do stuff like that with video
games.
Like
many comics and stuff.
They would come with an 80-page book describing the setting.
I don't know about that, because when I bought a video game, I want a video game, you know, and so I don't want to have to first like, oh, man, I'm really excited to pop this game into my Xbox and get going. Nope. Got to read a 40-page novella in order to understand it. So I don't know that I'd go that route, but I think there are ways they could have made that education of the universe a lot simpler using the same types of things we talked about with role playing games. Start with small and work your way outward. Have a tutorial.
Show. Or don't the tell. Setting.
Yeah. Show.
Valve
don't tell.
Is geniuses at the show. Don't tell. But you
know, Valve is actually guilty of this for me, too. The original Half-Life.
Valve is perfect.
The original Half-Life. I love that game. But how long is it into the game before you do anything?
Well, yeah, the original Half-Life.
You ride the tram. You walk around. I don't actually get to do anything.
For me, that series began at Half-Life 2.
I will defend Half-Life 1 and what you're talking about in two ways. You're not wrong. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a matter of shifting your perspective slightly. The tram ride where you're not doing anything, at least you can move a little bit. That's not a real heavy argument there,
right.
But that's the opening credits. Instead of sitting there and being forced to watch opening credits.
You know, and I would have been cool with it if as soon as you get off, you start doing things.
Well,
but
you walk
around for a while.
And one of the things that they defend themselves with when they talk about making of Half-Life 1, because for anyone who hasn't played Half-Life 1, you have this really long-ass tram ride where they show the credits. And things are happening in the background as you're tram riding through this facility that is, again, it's showing, not telling this sort of story of where you're at, what you're doing. And then you get to this sort of science lab where you have to go through security checkpoints and there's people talking. And that's the genius of it, is that there's all these little story tidbits of things happening, people talking to each other, the sort of story getting revealed. You don't have to listen to any of it, because in a normal game at that time, every time you would have walked up to one of those situations, it would have grabbed you, taken away control of your character and given you a cutscene where you had to go through dialogue
options. Modal dialogue.
But Half-Life, that was a conscious decision by Valve, is that they wanted to present this story, but they never at any one time wanted to take away control of your character. And they didn't. And you can blast right through all of that and get to what you need to get to.
Yeah, and they do that in like Portal and Portal 2 and such as well. Mm-hmm. You never lose control of your character for more than a very, very short period of time.
Just the end at the end.
Yeah, or like if there's a few points. Oh, I don't want to spoil it, right. But there's a few points where for a couple seconds you'll lose control or they'll force your character to do something. But it's very, very quick. They never give what I just described as modal dialogues where you get sucked into a cutscene or a dialogue that you have to interact with. You can't just say, don't care, bye.
Right.
What I've learned from games like these is, at least for me, if it took me that long to get interested in the game, I immediately make a save and save that point off. Because if I ever want to return to the game, I don't want to replay Mass Effect, the first 5 hours of it that I wasn't interested in. Half-Life, I've done the tram ride. I've done the walkthrough. I don't want to do that again. Any number of games the same thing.
Well, if that works in Half-Life, but like in Dragon Age, Mass Effect, a lot of times when I'm restarting the game, it's because I'm trying to play a different character.
Yeah.
And so I kind of have to replay the intro of the game to...
Remember training missions in video games where it isn't a matter of, oh, there's a long period of story.
Yeah, that's the first 5 hours of Mass Effect is the training mission.
Well, I mean, even then, that's interspersed with story and stuff. I mean, remember where you can't even start the game until you do like some sort of piloting course or danger course or training course.
Yeah. Two games that come to mind, I don't think either of them forced you to do it, but they definitely dumped you into them, was Rainbow Six, the very first one. And
Half-Life had a danger course, but it was completely optional.
And Splinter Cell did it too. So those series, I think they do that.
And Tomb Raider. They dumped you in the mansion. They don't force you to accomplish anything there.
Yeah.
At least not in the first couple games. In the more recent ones, actually, I think they do force you to do some things in the mansion before you leave.
City of Heroes even had something like that. When you first create your character, you have the choice of, do you go through the tutorial or do you jump right into the game?
Yeah.
I mean, and MMOs are another example of this that I've heard from people. You always hear the phrase, you know, well, you don't really know what the character's like until after level 20. Doesn't matter what game I've been in, with the exception of like Star Trek.
Right.
That wasn't the case. Every other game, when you create a character, that's one of the first things you hear. Oh, well, you haven't got it high enough to know what it's like. Well, if I'm going to dedicate this many hours to that character, I should know what the play style is like.
Now, I'm not saying you're wrong, because I agree with you, but I think the distinction I would draw between an MMO and most of these other games is in every other game we're talking about story, that it's taking them too long to make the story and characters interesting. In an MMO, because of the fact that the fundamental thing they hook you along with is Aaron Stack's petty little victories. You gain a level, you gain a power. You gain a level, you gain a new piece of gear.
They reward persistence and gameplay with power.
With power. And so in these MMOs, you have these game-changing, class-defining powers, which they can't give you at level one because otherwise the petty little victories to drag you along wouldn't be there. But on the flip side,
because the game isn't interesting enough just to play the game.
Yeah, which this is an explanation, not an excuse, because I think this is equally stupid. I'm really tired of the level curve drag along in MMOs. But within that paradigm, they can't give you the power immediately. But when you get it, the game changes so much that you really don't know what the character's like, but it's for a different reason. It's a reason of the character's abilities, the character's progression, not the fact that they're withholding some access to the plot or some depth to the characters.
And I acknowledge that I'm a different type of MMO player. I like the journey up. And I don't care about the end destination.
Right.
The petty victories for me are a big thing, though. I want the new powers. But for me, if I'm going to spend the money on a game, I want to enjoy the entire game all the way through it. Same thing if we're talking Mass Effect, if we're talking WoW, if we're talking City of Heroes. So for me, when you hear things like, it'll get good after this, or just power level your way through that, and then the game will start being fun, that to me is a failure in game design.
Absolutely agree. Though a great example to bring out the distinction I was just talking about, when you play through the Worgen story in World of Warcraft, it is an interesting story from start to finish, especially if you actually read all the stuff and pay attention to what people are saying and doing.
It was wonderful.
But it doesn't change the fact that, let's say you decide to play Worgen Druid, you really don't get a feel for the Druid class until about level 20. So you get immediate interest, but not immediate feel. And so I agree with you, it's still a problem, but it's a different problem. So I guess in closing, it sounds like we've got consensus here that we accept why it exists, and some of us are more willing than others to tolerate it, but that doesn't make it right.
Life's too short.
I have no tolerance at all. Yeah. If I'm not interested in the game within 5 minutes of putting the disc in, I'm not going to play it.
I've got other games that I can play that I know totally are good.
As usual, I'm right in the middle and Chris has nothing to say.
Well, you know, I can't really say anything on this particular topic because I'm not a huge video game player.
Yeah, he likes
play
his
nearly,
checkers and that's all he
the
needs
amount
to
of video
say.
Games you guys do. Basically, I do agree with what Dan had to say in regards to dealing with other media, whether it's a television show or if I am playing a board game, something has got to hook me with that board game very quickly, or it's got to be a concept that I can grab. Otherwise, I'm checking out. I may still play it, but I'm not playing to win. I'm playing to just be done with the game.
You know, you hit on a point there, Chris, the television show aspect. I've heard that about a lot of television shows, too.
Jericho did
it's not
me.
Good until it's three episodes, and it's not good until it's five. Yeah. It's not good until it's the next season. I'm much more forgiving of that because it was released serially.
It wasn't
one product all given at once.
I love Jericho. I adored Jericho. I quite frankly did not like it until about half a dozen episodes in.
End of the series?
Well, you know, and that's the thing.
The first season was like 24 episodes or something, so.
And that's part of the problem with a lot of TV shows. You know, if you watch a pilot episode of any show and then you compare it to an episode of that same show halfway through the season, it can be dramatically different and a lot better deeper into the season. The pilot episodes of most shows, they're not that great.
No.
They just aren't because all it is, it's setup. And after that, they also get feedback.
And they're able to make changes as they go.
Well, exactly. And then in successive episodes, you don't have to deal with that problem of establishing who this character is again and who they are and what they're doing and what their motivations are. Even the initial episode of Game of Thrones, it was good. It wasn't like knockdown, drag out awesome, but it's all set up. It's a huge setup episode so you can know who the major players are in this show. And it's going to get a lot better as it goes along. And that's just the way it is with most TV shows.
I know I am much more forgiving of TV shows that do things like that than I am other media like video games or books because TV shows don't require 100% of my attention. If I'm going to play a video game, that's what I'm doing. If I'm watching TV, chances are I have a book, I have my iPod, I have something else that I'm doing at the same time, and the TV is just on. It can take six episodes to get interesting, and that's fine, because the first six episodes, it's just background noise while I'm doing something interesting.
You know what? And I think that's why it makes it doubly hard for television shows now, because the majority of the people do exactly what you do while they're watching TV. They're doing something else. It's got to compete twice as hard for your attention.
RPG topic for today. We're not just going to talk about video games and some of you have seen text messages.
But you know what? That's what I did on Kicked in the Dice Bags that I was a host on again.
Derek, you're like their go-to dude or something.
I know. I swear. You're starting to do more episodes with them than you do with us. So
he's certainly like more interesting over there than he is here.
I'm like their backup guy.
They're back.
Whenever they're down a host and need somebody, they put up like the Chad symbol and I come running.
What does the Chad symbol look like?
Yeah, we decided that it's a guy with a big hairy chest.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of
Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay. The topic we're going to cover is deception at the table. Chad put this more bluntly at lying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in framing this conversation, because we're gonna talk about a lot of kinds of deception, both in game and metagame. The one thing we are taking off the table just because it's a different discussion, it's been had, we don't want to rehave it, is fudging dice.
All for it.
The game master fudging dice or players cheating with their dice.
All for it. Go on.
That is not part of this conversation. We are simply talking right around that. With that said, I came up with three basic categorizations of types of lying. The game master lies to a player character, which the game master could do in several different ways, and we'll come back to that. The player lying to the game master, which can occur in a couple ways, we'll talk about that, and a player lying to another player. All right, so let's start with the first one. The game master lying to the players. Now, I think what kind of complicates this issue is the fact that the game master is really three things. First of all, they're a rules referee, a rules or setting referee of simply dictating what is truth and what is fair. This attack hit, this attack didn't hit. You or do or don't have this power. This species can or cannot do a certain thing. Their second role is as the storyteller, explaining what is going on in the setting and world and the actions of the things around the characters as they perceive it. And the third is they take on the role of individual non-player characters. And in in these three roles, I have a different answer for each. I personally think, as the referee, the game master should never, ever lie to and deceive their players. It is the job of the game master to be a fair arbiter of the system, and as a result, if they are deceiving their players, claiming that something is or isn't true, I mean, this is no different than an umpire intentionally making a wrong call. It's just as crooked. I am completely against it.
I would agree with you 98%.
What's the 2%?
The 2% is actually when that referee starts to blend into the other categories, which it often does. The example that came to mind when you were just talking is, say, in the middle of combat, you're running a monster, the party's fighting it. You know that one of the character's weapons does absolutely nothing to this monster. However, there's no way that the players would necessarily know this. Their characters wouldn't know it. So when that character hits my monster, I write down damage. I'll do it every time. It's a deception as a referee, but it's necessary. Yeah, and I think that's largely because it merges into that storyteller aspect. Because if I didn't write down damage, I am admitting a piece of knowledge out of character that's then going to filter down to the in-character knowledge of the players.
Well, as long as you're not telling them specifically, you did 5 points of damage, I completely agree.
Well, and
I'm all for writing stuff like that down.
This gets into, I suppose, the types of deception, because in this case, you're not per se lying to them. You're not telling them you did X, Y, Z. You're just saying your sword struck and then you write something down. An example of this that...
But it is deception.
Yes.
It is.
Not
yeah.
lying.
An example of this I do on, on a regular...
Misdirection.
Example this I do on a regular basis is when I run that ship-on-ship Star Trek game. If, for example, one ship has its sensors down, there's a phase of the game where we do sensor questions, where the ships are allowed to scan each other and try and figure things out. Well, I can't let on to whether one ship has its sensors down or not, so I will walk over to the science officer in one ship and be like, okay, your sensors are down, but just point to the question you would ask. Okay, really? And I'll write something down on a note card, and I'll go over to the other side and say, okay, show me your engineering console, and I'll write something down. And truth is, their sensors are offline. I'm not telling them anything. I'm actually drawing a picture of a smiley face or something like that. But then I go back and show them, okay, here's a smiley face because your sensors are down. But I have to keep that double blind. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with you for two reasons. One, as you said, this could bleed over into your role as storyteller. But I think also it's never a lie. You're not saying to them, I don't know, I guess the equivalent would be me saying your sensors are up, when in truth they're down and the crew ought to know they're down.
Right.
And they know exactly what the damage did. I'm
like,
not
well, what you're describing, Dan, I mean, it is not, that's really is not a deception. What you're doing is you're playing the game by the rules necessary for that particular game. You've got to play it that way because, like you said, you got to keep up that double blind. That's a necessary component in that particular game that you're playing. So I wouldn't even classify that as being a deception.
Well, I think I would, for a simple reason that it is deception, but it's a deception of the other team. I am implying a truth to the other team that isn't true. And what Johan was describing, I think, is the same thing, except it's the double blind between the game master and the players.
Right.
That there are truths about the world,
yes,
in this case, his monsters impervious to normal weapons. That
And I think there's degrees of that, though, too, because in Johan's base description of that, characters really have no inkling as to what's going on. But if you get into more of a descriptive nature as to what happened, that in turn might drop clues. Now, like the sword hits the monster and clearly just bounces off is one thing, but the sword slicing into the monster and it creates a cut, and maybe a couple rounds later they notice that the cut seals on its own. There's a degree there, I think, where it varies on a case-to-case basis.
So the next one is the game master as storyteller. The game master is the person who conveys plot and conveys setting, or maybe conveys NPCs in the general sense. We'll get to playing specific NPCs here in a second.
In this instance, my opinion is that the GM really can't ever lie. And what I mean by that is this, since you're the one who's telling the story, if you decide to make a change like that, you're the only one who will ever know it. So
Right. You
can only be not being true to yourself or to your original true story. But as far as anyone else knows, you're not lying to them. If you change something on the spot just because the players do something or they figured something out or whatever, it's kind of an interesting thing because, yes, maybe you're not really doing what you planned, but it's not really a lie. Well, you're just changing it on the spot.
What our framing a while back of, are there dwarves in this campaign? If I directly ask you that, would that fall under this category for you as well, or would that be under something else?
I think it would. And Pat, let me ask you a question. Would you accept that it might be necessary within that context for the game master to either state up front at the start of the campaign, or perhaps remind the players every so often that what I'm telling you is your perceptions of the world, what you are seeing, not necessarily the actual truth? To give answers,
I think that depends on how good a storyteller you are. I think if you're a good enough storyteller, you don't need to make that kind of pronouncement. What I'm saying is, you know, if you tell the story correctly, it should come off that way, that, oh, we assumed things were a certain way. Now we've learned more about it and we have realized our perceptions were not entirely fully formed.
Yeah. I agree with Pat here. For me, the GM, from a storyteller standpoint, is the single source of truth about the world that I'm playing in. So if the GM is lying to me about the world that I'm playing in, that to me is going to affect the story and my enjoyment of it. If the GM, however, says something on the lines of, it looks like this, you believe it's this, you know it to be this, you know it to be, is a different thing than it being. I know the sky is blue. I go outside, it's night. The sky isn't blue right now. I was wrong. But you never actually said the sky is blue. You say you know it to be blue. To me, there's a difference there.
When I run a game, any game that I run, my players are always making assumptions. And they're making assumptions based on what I tell them, whether they be lies or truth. Generally speaking, I don't lie to my players because I believe in a compact of trust between the player and the GM. But there is always presumptions. There's always assumptions. As a GM, I have to sit there and I let them be wrong. I don't lie to my players, but I let them be wrong about most of their assumptions because that is how their characters see the world. Now, if it's something that's obvious, like they're saying the sky is blue when in this world the sky is a sort of dark green color and they keep assuming the sky is blue, well, you know, okay, I'll correct them on that one. That's not a presumption, it's a misunderstanding, and there's just a little course correction.
An example where this really became painfully powerful for me was the Epoch of Risos game that I ran for you guys a while back. Because of the fact that the basic setup of the galaxy is that the galaxy, the known galaxy, is collectively the victim of a trademark Dan What's Really Going On document. So when you guys who were new to this setting were asking me, well, what can I do? What can I play? Is this out there? Is that out there? Does this technology exist? And in many cases, it's like, well, yeah, maybe it does. I'm thinking this internally, but this is something that nobody really knows.
Right.
This hasn't come up in the story yet. That species hasn't been encountered. That technology hasn't surfaced. This secret society over here, which is about to unleash this whatever, nobody knows about yet. I found myself having to really carefully frame these proclamations to say, I can't go into a lot of detail about a lot of things, but within your experience, you have only seen this, this, and this. You've never seen these things occur. You've never seen a teleporter. Do teleporters exist? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I know whether they do or don't, but I can't tell you whether they do or don't, because if I tell you they do, it's a plot reveal. If I tell you they don't, well, now you know whenever I refuse to answer, the answer is yes.
Right.
Well, and see, I don't have any problem at all with that, because for me, that is what brings the mystery of the game, sort of the mythos and the fun of discovery. It is exactly the kind of thing that you're describing there that I love about a game, because yes, in our experience, we've never been around these types of things. And then all of a sudden when you discover it, it's like, oh my God, this technology or this race or this whatever exists. We didn't know this before. We just made a discovery. That's some of the awesomeness of the game.
Yeah, I had that moment in my very first game, the Sky's a Glass game. I had no idea robots existed in that setting until we ran across one. Chad knew they existed. He had no big surprise when the thing we're fighting is a robot, but we had had all of the setting given to us of our town, no indication of that level of military combat. So the first time we run into it, yeah, I was caught off guard, and it was a wonderful moment when I realized, oh, there's robots here. I didn't know that. But if I would have come out and asked Dan ahead of time, are there robots in the setting? I would have been cheating myself out of it.
Yeah, in that case, so it's not a big secret of the setting. I would have actually told you, yes, you're aware that such things did exist.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes what you're talking about here is, I guess as players, you just sort of need to have some common sense about some of the questions you might ask about a world or something like that. It's like, I guess some common sense things are one thing, but if you want to start doing these really probing things about some obscure things about the campaign before it even starts, that's kind of like what you're saying. It can kind of shoot yourself in the foot, or it's kind of like reading the end of a book, which we all know how I love so much. Don't ask up front, just experience it. Go with the flow and see what happens. Well, let it play out.
You know what, Pat? That's an angle we haven't really tackled yet that I think is a good one, which is that some of this is incumbent upon the players to, number one, not put the game master in that position. I mean, don't be a douche. And number two, doubly so if you want the experience. I mean, there is a difference between someone spoiling a book, a movie, or a video game for you, and then you walking up to someone and saying, does Snape kill Dumbledore? You get the answer and then get cheated out of that moment in the book.
Yeah, I like the angle that you approach, Dan, and I think that's where I'm similar when it comes to my style, is if I'm asked questions of that nature, I try and frame the answers within the perceptions and the realities of what that character might know based upon where they're from, where they're at. For them, is it the Civil War, or for them, is it the War of Northern Aggression? It's in their character's field of life and their life experiences up to that point.
The last role of GM plays that we're going to deal with ties right into our second category, because of the fact that we're talking about the Game Master as a specific non-player character, because in the context of non-player character, you're lying to a PC, and of course, in return, the PC may be lying to the non-player character, and so thus this ties us...
Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Right into the PC lying to the GM. I think this is a simpler one. Does anyone here, I mean, object to the basic concept that NPCs, like all other people, tell lies?
Yeah. I don't think that any NPC I've ever encountered has told me a truth. I expect everything they say is a dirty, dirty lie.
Chad, or Pat, you'd be surprised how many of the characters in my games are telling you the complete truth, sometimes leaving out critical details, other times intentionally telling truths that seem to contradict, but I know somewhere in the background are paradoxical.
You know, Dan,
NPCs are actually shockingly honest.
So
they don't have to make bluff checks.
Yeah,
exactly.
Actually, Dan, I have the same problem when I run a game, but from a different perspective. Everyone, especially in this current campaign, everyone assumes they're being lied to by the NPCs because all the characters are out for themselves and kind of assholes, and so they assume everybody else is an asshole who's out for their stuff and power.
I think it's also because you're an opportunistic GM. The minute we start trusting someone, they will become a lying backstabber.
Who has that become?
It's not that I'm out for myself. I'm just an objectivist.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Rand. So who has done that in our current campaign?
No one, because we haven't trusted anyone.
Yeah.
That's why.
Uh-huh.
We've never found ourselves without a home because we have home insurance.
And in fact, in the last chapter, the big, bad, horrible, evil guy was not.
Yeah.
And you killed him anyway.
I did no such thing.
I killed him.
I tried to save his life.
You sure did.
You didn't try very hard.
I tried to save his life, but not at the expense of your life. I don't think there's a whole lot of discussion there.
Other than it's awesome.
Well, except for one point, and I don't want to beat this one to death, but we will hit it briefly.
Unlike what Wayne did to the big bad.
He stabbed him to death. He didn't beat him to death. Which is the mechanical versus the role play. And let's just do a quick poll. For example, in Chad's case, I know that he prefers that you would role play it to roll it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you would probably forego rolling in many cases if it was role played well and vice versa. Played really poorly, you wouldn't even give us a roll. I am of the opinion, as I stated on several episodes, so I won't reiterate it except for the benefit of people who are tuning in for the first time, I balance the two. I want you to role play it just so I understand your angle. And based on your angle, I will kind of internally gauge a plausibility. And if you're really creative, I might give you a bonus. If you're kind of saying something really stupid, I might give you a penalty. But you are not your character. So I totally want that role because the fact is I don't want someone who's uncharismatic to never be able to play a charismatic character.
I hate that logic because to me that logic says roles, like ROLL roles, are for socially handicapped people. If you have the inability to lie or to cajole or to whatever, because you are socially inept, then don't worry. That's what dice rolling is for.
Well, and I disagree with that. But the way I interpret what you're saying is that you should only ever play characters that are essentially yourself. I should only ever play a character that's me.
What I said it.
But I'm interpreting it. But what you're saying is, maybe I'm not the only. If I'm not that charismatic, then
I shouldn't
play a character that has a high charisma score because I can't pull it off.
See, well, I frame this in the form of.
I'm interpreting it that way as well.
That's totally what I heard too. See,
well, let me frame this.
I'm justified this time.
Okay, well, hold on. Let me frame this in the form of a question, Chad. where I'm hoping you can draw out the difference between what we're interpreting, what you mean.
Well, remember what I said is I disagree with the logic. It's not that I disagree with rules or dice rolling. Right. I disagree with the logical argument that says the reason why we have dice rolls for social checks, not hitting somebody with a sword, but for the sort of social checks, is because there's a lot of role players out there who are socially inept and they cannot role play out whatever that social situation is. So we have dice rolls to make up for that.
Okay.
And I disagree with that that reasoning. I disagree with that logic.
Let me give you an example that just came up actually in not our most recent game, but the second to last game session. Pat's character is supposed to be this 1,000-year-old, 1,500-year-old politician who, even when he's dead, is in the soul pool playing politics. He is the height of the Roman Senate manipulator.
Right.
He has lifetimes, literally 18 lifetimes, plus who knows how many years dead, perfecting this art. He got drug in front of the city for a debate, but because Pat himself is not good at social maneuvering and debate and Roman senatorial politics on the spot, he got flustered and did not perform as well as his character should have. Thus, a die roll against his extremely high social skills would have allowed him to exercise.
Which he does not have, because we're playing a game that doesn't have a whole lot of social skills.
But the point is, it would have allowed him to exercise a strength of his character that Pat doesn't possess, thus allowing him to play a character that's not like himself. Help me understand, what's the disagreement that you would have with that structure?
Because I think that you could take a step back from that. What you can say is, instead of, okay, stop, time out, let's roll this and see what the dice tell us. Because to me, if the dice screw up,
right,
then you could still say, well, he has all this lifetime of achievement and he has all this power and he has all this ability and he has all this 18 lifetimes and all this experience. He just rolled a one. And to me, that's the same thing as saying, well, I flubbed my lines. I think one of the many, many things you can do is to take a step back and to say, okay, we're going to have this debate. How do we want this to play out? It's like, okay, I'm this Roman senator type guy. You're arguing against a peasant, which he wasn't. He was actually arguing with a captain of industry in his and a really rich, educated dude. And, you know, it's like, how do you want this to go? You tell me how. It's like, I want this to go down this certain way. I want to go down this path. Let's role play this out and go down this path. And I'll role play my character out to go down that path. And I assume that he would role play his character out to go down that path as well. And it's something that we can talk about. It's not a, okay, stop the game, let's have a 3-hour conversation on and architect the game out. It's just a couple of sentences. I want to go down like this.
That sounds great. Unfortunately, it didn't play out that way.
Right.
But I think the problem there was that I didn't know that was kind of on the table. I would have.
Totally
I know you are. It's just that I'm more used. I'm just much more used to
in a game.
I'm just much more used to not taking a step back, but playing and role playing and being in character and reacting to a situation in character right then and there. But what you suggested is what I should have done, and that would have been fine, and that would have worked perfectly. Although I think that's also kind of like what Dan is saying with his combination of set it up a little bit and then use that as a modifier to the role. He's going to use the die roll. Yeah. You're just going to use the narrative. Let's talk about that, and then we'll figure out where we're going to go and go there.
I'm not against rules per se. I mean, I kind of am on a personal level, but we just took a break here. One of the things I said to Pat off the mics is that we're playing D&D and the social rules just aren't that interesting. It's more interesting to roll out hitting something with a sword or casting a spell than it is to make a diplomacy check. And I would much rather role play that out, even if the person isn't good at lying, debate, diplomacy, whatever it is they're trying to do. They could pull me aside and say, hey, this is the road I want to go down with this. Okay, let's make that scene work. Or you could even say to me, I would make this point, I'd make this point, and this is what I would say. And I don't want to role play it out. or I know that you don't want to roleplay that. And what I would do is I would take that scene, I'd say, well, my NPC says blah, 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 and Pat makes a fiery speech and brings up his passion and crushes his opponent with his words of weightiness or whatever. And we could play it out that way. What my ultimate point is that I just don't like the argument that social rules exist only for socially handicapped people, because I believe that A, that's really insulting, and B, they could be interesting. Make the social rules interesting and cool. And that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of games out there that do that.
The only point in there I would disagree with, I get your point.
Right.
And I don't, well, it's not my style of game mastering, I don't per se disagree with it, except the one point about it's insulting, which is, I think it's only insulting if you take it from the standpoint, gamers are all social enough, therefore right. We need social skills. Because of the fact that I say, look, let's say you want to play a scientist. Not everyone's a scientist. Not everyone's right. A nuclear physicist. And so,
if I roll to hit you with
I want to bench press 500 pounds with my fighter character.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't bench press 500 pounds.
And the same thing's true of combat. I do not make this rule with combat.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I want to hit the NPC with an axe. Do I take an axe and hit Dan over the head with it?
I guess sometimes, but mostly no.
The
problem I've always had with your argument, Chad, is it takes it to the extreme. I can debate just fine if I'm debating as me. I do sometimes have a problem if I'm trying to debate in character. But I'm at a debate level, let's say I'm at a 5. That doesn't mean I'm socially inadequate in any way. My character is at a debate level 9. I can't socially do what my character does. I don't think that's insulting for me to say I'd like a role on this.
And one other thing I would like to bring up as well is that the rules are also there for the opposite problem, which I have come across. Which is the gamer who is a silver-tongued frickin' devil
right. In
real life, can talk his way out of any situation, and plays a character with a charisma of 8 and no social skills, who mysteriously can talk his way out of any situation.
And I think every group has this.
To have those
Chad, we're
there.
Looking at you. You are the person in our group capable of doing this.
The other type of player line is the player lying to the game master as the game master. Not as an NPC, but the player...
It's the complete opposite side of the coin of saying, can the game master lie to the players?
Yes. And once again, I would take the same tact of, I think this is an extremely bad idea, except in very certain contexts and very limited situations.
Are you using Johan's 2%? Do you, like, 98% of the time you think it's a bad idea?
I'll use my 2%.
Okay.
Personally, my mindset on this is...
I'd say about 97%.
It's always wrong, and if you feel you have to do it, you have a larger issue that needs to be addressed that you should
Bingo.
Bring out at the table.
Bingo. It's always wrong, it's just that sometimes not doing it is more wrong.
I've only, that I can recall, had to do this once in a game.
Well, let me ask you real quick.
Yes.
I don't disagree. Why is it wrong? Why is it wrong for a player to lie to the game master in the context that, not ICLEY, but in the context of the
game? Because of the fact that, look, there's two parts to our hobby. Role-playing, game.
Yeah.
The role-playing part is about human interactions, which are complex, convoluted, and possibly full of deceit. The game part, I mean, if you lied about the game part, this is no different than lying about where a tennis ball hit down.
Well, you're not talking about lying. Like, I make a roll and you say, what did I get? And I say 20 and I don't show you the die because it didn't roll a 20.
Well, okay.
That's different.
Here's my answer, Chad. GM is an arbitrator, and to be able to properly arbitrate, he needs to have all of the information in front of him.
Right.
If you are withholding a piece of information or giving him blatantly false information, he can't make a legitimate, fairly informed arbitration.
And
that's why I think it's wrong.
The only time I've ever had to do it was in a single game where I didn't trust the game master to be fair.
Greater problem.
Right.
Exactly.
That's the problem, is that you don't trust your GM.
I knew there were certain things where failure was guaranteed. He had his Baron von Badasses I wasn't allowed to touch. And I knew the only way I could succeed in action was I took a note card, wrote down on it, put it in front of him and said, I want you to know this is an action I just did. Don't turn it over. We played the scene out. I said, okay, now the scene's done. Turn it over. And I kind of had to blindside him. And that's horribly dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bigger problem.
I would hate it if you did that to me. Beyond the fact that I know why you did it to him.
Yes.
And I agree with why you did it to him. I would hate that. Why? Because I would look at you and I'm like, why can't I flip this over and read it? And then we would have to have that conversation.
Yeah. I would, honestly, if you actually have to have that conversation then,
there's
been a failure already in the game. That conversation should have happened before then. It should never come to a head
Yes.
In that kind of a situation.
Well, and I want to say in fairness that this was some years ago.
Teenage gaming, all that stuff.
It wasn't quite teenage gaming, but it was not a whole lot past that. I want to say that this is a person who I know has developed since then. We've developed since then, et cetera, et cetera.
I haven't.
But, but you know, it just, it was a sign of a bigger problem. And if you're in a game where you can't trust your game master with all the information because they have too many sacred cows that you can't affect, you've got another problem in the game.
But I would like to applaud your passive-aggressive solution to the problem. I approve.
As a player, I can't whip out Tomb of Horrors and drop it on him, and so that's the best I can do.
Just a thermal detonator.
Actually, it was a thermal detonator, so... What this still leaves is the entire topic of player character line, and we actually have several angles we want to cover on this, including the role-playing aspect of it, the metagame aspect of it, and questions about using rules against other players. But there's so much to discuss there that I don't think we can fit it into a reasonable amount of time on
this. Who knew deception could be so interesting?
Episode. And so what we will do is we will come back to that next episode. So I guess we will consider this line part one, and we will come back to line part two next show. So I guess that's where we're going to leave this one.
That's right. We lied to you about completely covering this topic in one episode.
Damn right.
So, roll for that.
So the only two quick things as we close this out is, first off, we're going to be doing the charity auction probably starting next week. So don't forget to get out there and get your ideas in for that. And also, when the show drops, I think you're going to have like another day or two to get in on Mikey's Kickstarter thing and help him finish that out. So I'll link that in the show notes as well. As for you guys, have a great week and wonderful games, and we will catch you same time next week.
And Wayne's still trying to get his dice out so he can roll his bluff check. Isn't that exciting?
I don't have one in here.
No.
Be a master debater.
See, then you can't lie. You can't roll, you can't lie.
Can we just get to see you?
See ya.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.